deciding to make music my full-time job took a lot of convincing myself. I spent years telling myself that this obsessive interest in music of mine was merely a passing hobby. As the years rolled and I did not let up, collecting records, going to shows, playing in bands, eventually I was forced to admit that the job I wanted was in music, more specifically, playing in a touring band full time. My hesitation stemmed from my idea of it. It was a fool's wish to be a musician full time. The competition is outrageous. The odds of it working out are stacked up against you, and even if you do achieve a modicum of success, it's fleeting. To make it even more laughable, I can't read music, don't know music theory. I'm anything but a studied musician. I just listen to records. Hearing someone say that they want to be in a rock band is like hearing a 5-year-old child say they want to play on the New York Yankees. It's sweet, but give me a break. So I tricked myself and enrolled into film school, and that's where I remained for 5 years after high school. If there's anything I learned in film school, it's that your original vision as an aspiring auteur will hardly ever be truly realized. It will be constantly picked apart by not only people you disagree with, but for whom you have little respect. So, I bailed early after realizing this insight. It helped me face the all-too-obvious truth that my future lay in music, whether I liked it or not. Now, music is still an ambition filled with compromise, but if you surround yourself with the right people, for a lot less at stake, you can have your vision, partially, if not fully, seen through to fruition. Being in a band with people who share the same goal is still filled with compromise, arguments, and accommodation, but shared interests on a level playing field help alleviate the anxiety one may feel when conceding to higher-ups, as is the case many times in film. Having gone through the filmic process, albeit in the protective environment of academia, I have a true respect and admiration for those who trudged forward with their cinematic visions and saw them to fruition. It takes someone of strong stuff, stronger stuff than I sure have, to persevere through the madness of the film world and to come out of it with anything resembling a viewable product. If you can achieve success and respect in this field, you not only are meant to be there, you are a rare specimen. Jonas Åkerlund is someone I see who sort of did the opposite of what I did. Jonas was in the first incarnation of Bathory, the legendary Swedish death metal band, but chose to pursue his true calling in cinema. But music was second nature to Jonas, as his breakthrough came via the music video world, making innovative 3 or 4 minute masterpieces for musicians like The Prodigy, Roxette, Madonna, and Metallica. His work only catapulted him upward, and he went on to work with Paul McCartney, The Rolling Stones, Lady Gaga, Ozzy Osbourne, Taylor Swift, U2, Beyoncé, and even more Madonna, and even more Metallica. His videography reads like a Best of Video Awards ceremony show card. You don't get to be this good making music videos without eventually entering into the feature film world, and Jonas has done just that with films like Spun, Small Apartments, his upcoming new film out in 2019 called Polar with Mads Mikkelsen and Vanessa Hudgens, shot in Toronto, I might add, and Lords of Chaos coming out later this year. Lords of Chaos is the film that intrigues me and the rest of the heavy music world the most. It is a movie about the Norwegian black metal scene of the 1990s and the chaos that swirled within it. It isn't an adaptation of the book, it only took the book's name. If there's anyone in the film world qualified to tell this story, it's Jonas Åkerlund. As co-founder of Bathory, his metal cred is undeniable and impenetrable. Aside from the music, the world of metal is a world made up of shallow opinions, and everyone has one. At the end of the day, those who can will do. And that's what Jonas Åkerlund does. He made the film everyone wanted to see, but were too unqualified and or too chicken shit to make. The fact that Lords of Chaos, the book, is a Feral House book, and my book is out on Feral House too. And that was another outside connection that interested me in the movie. Now, I haven't seen the film as I'm putting this podcast episode together, but as you will hear, it was done with the utmost respect to the scene, to its players, and to the story. From one very, very highly respected source who has seen the movie, his only words to me were, "You're gonna love it." So I met Jonas Åkerlund at his place in Los Angeles. This podcast is a loose conversation, but talk did end up revolving around music and his Lords of Chaos film. I could have easily talked to Jonas about a number of other subjects. Bathory, for example, could have taken up an entire episode on its own. But this is my captured talk with Jonas on that day in sunny LA, hours before we hit the stage at the Viper Room. I want to thank Jonas and Gina for setting this up, and to Mark Ahi for putting me in touch with Jonas. Thanks to Blue Mic Microphones and Skullcandy Headphones, this episode can be heard on iTunes, SoundCloud, and you can now hear this podcast on Spotify. So please subscribe to it. I hope you enjoy this one. It's with the auteur himself, Mr. Jonas Åkerlund, and it starts now. The Daniel Jones podcast is the best around. They fled again as Daniels go out to love for free. I'm so glad I do sometimes. Damn it, from fucked up. Stop playing. Hang down, down.
When the weather is bad and there's nothing much to do, take a listen, would you now, to what Danko Jones would do. It's the middle of the night and you better do it fast. Turn the speakers up loud for Danko's podcast.
I began to notice that Danko was completely nuts. He'd suddenly start making weird sounds and scary faces for no reason at all. And it wasn't just embarrassing, it was alarming. And now, since I'm a devout Catholic, I asked my local parish priest about Danko's condition, and he was sure Danko was possessed by Satan. So I helped my priest perform an exorcism on Danko that very day, but it didn't work. The dude is seriously screwed, and according to my parish priest, will burn in hell for all of eternity if he doesn't get himself checked out.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, get ready, because the Danko Jones podcast starts now!
I am sitting in Jonas Åkerlund's house. What is this? A cabana in your backyard in Los Angeles?
We call it the cabana, but I don't even know what a cabana is. But it's a little outdoor indoor thing right next to the pool. Yes,
it's very nice. And when we were driving by, I had a feeling this was your place because it just had. It just had that vibe, you know what I mean? That dark vibe. So it was cool. And it's great to meet you. We have a mutual friend, Mark.
Yeah, Mark.
From Toronto.
Yeah.
And he was telling me about you and working with you. You just finished Polar in Toronto. And then he mentioned that you had Lords of Chaos ready to go. Mm. And did you screen it while you were in Toronto?
Yeah, we did. Well... it wasn't an official screening, but when we started in pre-production to work on Polar, there was so many of the crew and friends up there who was curious to see the movie. So we set up a little screening, and then that was packed, so we did another screening. And of course, I should have invited you, Danko, because you would have been great to have you there. Yeah. But Sam Dunn came, which is a local friend of mine, and then mostly the crew guys came, so yeah.
Yeah, Sam's a great guy. I was on his Banger TV thing where we debated about Sepultura for, I think it's called Locked Horns.
Okay.
So we went through the whole discography and talked about the albums and stuff. Sam's a great guy.
Yeah, he's like a professor in all this stuff that we all like.
Yeah. So when I found out that you were doing, it's finished and it's ready to go, the Lords of Chaos movie, based on the Lords of Chaos book, which is on Feral House. I was telling you off the podcast, Mike, that my book is on Feral House. So there is a kind of a connection we have due to the Lords of Chaos. And I've read Lords of Chaos. I read it 10 years ago or 12 years ago, and it's a very, you said it yourself, it's a very charged book. It's very divisive. Even within the metal scene, taking on a project like that, and from what I understand, it's been in the works for since 05, 06. Am I wrong?
You mean the making of the
production?
Movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, actually way longer for me, because I had the idea of making a movie about the relationship between Varg and Hieronymus early on.
Okay.
And I was as curious as everybody else. It's like, what really happened, and fascinated about these events, and how could it go that wrong, and like all those questions that we had, and a lot of them was answered in documentaries and books and just by knowing people in the scene. But it got stuck with me, and I kept thinking that this would be a great movie. And eventually, once we got a little bit more close to actually trying to make it happen, we decided to buy the rights to Lords of Chaos, the book,
right,
just to clear the names, and because I like the title. But you know, it's like the book is criticized, and it's everything is criticized. That's part of the black metal scene, you know. It's
yes.
Like, and nothing is really true unless you were there, unless you were, you know, true. And I obviously wasn't there, but I feel close to the scene because I came from the Swedish side of it, and I feel close to it because I've been thinking so much about it. And that gave me enough juice to give it a go and try to do it. And the movie isn't in any way based on the book as much as it's based on all the other research that I've done around the project. Because in Lords of Chaos, the book, it's just like literally a few chapters in the middle that deals with what I'm talking about.
But those are the most talked about chapters. That's the story that's most talked about.
Yeah, of course. That's what made the whole scene famous.
Yeah.
Up till this day. It's like nobody can't really compete with that. But in my opinion, both musically and you know, the events, it's just, you know, it's down in history, and it's weird though why it is, because young kids do stupid things around the world every day, you know. As we're speaking now, some kid is shooting some other kid somewhere around the world, but this story just kept coming back to me and to a lot of other people. It became one of those stories that a lot of people think they own, and that's it makes it a really sensitive matter. Not only are you in black metal when you are skeptical to everything, but it's also a sensitive story because a lot of people think that they actually own this story. This is my story. I know it better than anybody else. And the truth is, they don't. A lot of people who were even there doesn't even know the story anymore. But years has passed, and the story has been changed and told in so many different ways. So what I did with the movie was like try to be as close to the reality as I can, but who am I to say that this is what happened? So in the beginning of the movie, it says based on truth, and then after a second it comes up and lies, because I think I'm close to the reality, and I think I know. I mean, technically I know what happened, and I read all the police reports, and I know how the crime scenes looked, and I know a lot about the events, but their motivation and why it happened and all that has to be speculation. I don't even think anybody who was there know, you know. And obviously Hieronymus and Pelle are both dead, so they don't know, you know. So it's a tough movie to make, but it's a very interesting movie for a lot of people to see.
Oh, yeah. Regardless if you are a critic of the movie existing, even before you see it, you're going to want to see it. Mm. Now, you said you know the story, or you had to learn the story. How did you do that? Did you go to Bergen? Did you go to Fantoft? Did you talk to scenesters?
Yeah, a little bit of both. I mean, just going online, there's a ton of information. But I did go to all the places. I talked to a lot of people that was around the scene. I read everything that there is to read. I read all the police reports. You know, I've spoken to Hieronymus' parents. I've spoken to Pelle's brother. You know, like a lot of research, you know, just to get to as close as I could to understand what happened.
When you, like, we spent enough time in Norway and in Bergen specifically, in the music scene and in the heavy music scene. So when you do that, eventually you realize everybody knows Varg, and Varg is actually, for them, he's an easy person to get a hold of. Did you talk to Varg? Was there any contact?
No. No, I haven't had any contact with Varg. And I never tried to have contact with him either. Mm. I mean, he's been very outspoken about his point of view in different interviews, even though he changed the story a little bit over the years. But it's still... That was enough for me to build his character in the film. And, you know, it's like, you know, the relationship between Varg and Euronymous, which is really the interesting part of this story in my point of view. I think it's impossible to really figure out what happened and why it happened. You know, the easy answer is what Varg is saying when he's talking about the contracts and the threats that Euronymous was sending out and all that. But it's pretty extreme what happened, and to understand in depth what really happened and how they felt about it when it came down, it's close to impossible. And I wonder if anybody, like I said, if anybody that was there even know, you know, how much do we really remember 30 years ago?
Yeah.
You know, but if you keep telling the story for 30 years, the story will change a little bit.
It's like broken telephone.
Yeah, the fish is this big now, yeah. You know? So I take it a little bit with a grain of salt with what I hear, but and again, my responsibility is also to make a movie. So with saying in the beginning of the movie that it is based on truth and lies, that I kind of sign away my responsibility a little bit to the reality, but I at the same time I'm saying that this actually happened. So that was my solution to get away with what I'd done in this film.
You're not making a documentary, you're making a movie.
Yeah, right? But even documentaries are always angled somehow, yeah. You know, and give you some sort of opinion. But this is clearly a movie with English speaking actors that play Norwegian characters and actors with wigs and instruments. That's tough, man. It's not really something that I wouldn't in normal go for, because I've only seen people fail with that. But that was just part of the challenge, you know. And my actors were so deep into their characters, you know.
Now, when you take on a music film and you're talking about actors pretending to play instruments, your videography CV is pretty much worldwide known. I don't have to go down the list. I can do that in the intro, or people probably automatically know. But also, I think what a lot of people don't know readily about you is that you do have super AAA cred in the metal community with your time in Bathory. And when you see an actor pretending to play drums, does the musician's side of you take over, going, no, you're totally playing that role completely fake, or, you know what I mean? Like, you could, when you film a video, the drummer is the drummer. He's right. Already, or she's already a drummer. But how are you able to bridge all those two sides of you?
Well, for starters, you'll be surprised how many musicians I shoot in my music videos that don't know there's music. So there's always an element of using, film techniques to get it right. But no, I was very keen on getting it right. And I personally hate movies when I see it's wrong, you know. And when a T-shirt is wrong, because that T-shirt didn't come out until like a year later, or when the shoes is not right era, or, you know, like, so I was very keen on getting everything right. Luckily, they took a lot of pictures. The whole black metal scenes, they loved taking pictures. I mean, now everybody has their camera in the pocket, but for back then, pre-internet and pre-mobile phones, they were very good at taking pictures. So I had a lot of research material to do in terms of look and style and all that, which was great. And when it came to the instruments, I got it down. I got it right. And Necrobutcher told me, I don't know if you're aware, but I did through when I shot Lords of Chaos, I did a video for Metallica, and I used my actors in costume to
for the Death Magnetic, those 12 videos.
Yeah, I did right. one of those.
Right, right.
I got a phone call from Lars, and I was like, dude, I'm shooting a movie. I can't make your video right now. And then I started to think, wait a minute, I got these great actors with instruments, and they look fucking awesome. So I got my actors to learn one more song. I was like, you guys are learning like these 12 songs, so you may as well learn one more. So we shot a music video with my actors for the Metallica song "Man Unkind," it's called. Mm-hmm. And Necrobutcher, who is the bass player of Mayhem.
Sorry, this is for Hardwired.
To yeah.
Self-destruct.
Not, yeah.
Not. I said Death Magnetic. Sorry.
Oh yeah, you did. Yeah, yeah. You
Sorry.
Did.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Necrobutcher from Mayhem saw yes. the video, and he told me that's. That's when he knew that this movie is going to be good.
Wow.
He said it looked exactly like it did.
Right.
The instruments were right, the water was right, and the guys played it right. And, you know, it's like, and on the technical side of it, it was like the way we did it was basically I gave my actors their instruments early on so they could practice and listen, and then they rehearsed hours and hours every day. I had a couple of consultants that were there to support them and help them. The one that the tough one was obviously the drummer, because it's a lot of technical drumming, and Hellhammer's way of playing drums is really hard. I mean, I don't think even a good drummer could duplicate the way he do it, because he's very specific in how he play. But we got it right, you know. And to be honest, when you see the end result, I didn't have to cheat it as much as I thought I would, because they got it right. Just based on, if you would unplug the playback and hear how they played it, it probably sound horrible,
right, right.
But it looked right.
Right. Well, that's all that matters.
It's all that matters. And Anthony, who played Hellhammer in the film, he got the drums right, really good. He wasn't a first timer. He's actually a singer in a band, so he was familiar with the drums, but all the other guys had never even held an instrument. Rory, who plays Euronymous in the film, he never had a guitar in his life.
And is that Macaulay Culkin's brother, Rory?
Yeah, Rory Culkin. Yeah, he's right. The little brother in the big Culkin family. Yeah.
Right. Wow. So these are kind of budding actors that are they're new actors, but. This could
Yeah, it's like, you know, I got a great group of kids with Rory and Emery Cohen, who played Varg in the film, and Jack Kilmer, who's playing Peledad.
Oh, right. Yeah, because that whole story is also part of the whole Mayhem Euronymous.
It's kind of the first act in the film. That's kind of like what sets off the whole thing, yeah.
Yeah. In the book, there's also kind of a side story about Bard Faust from Emperor. Did you touch on that?
Yeah,
story as well?
That's in the film too.
Wow. Okay.
And the reason why I kept that in the film is because that, I mean, obviously it was a big, very famous event, but it also felt like after Pelle's suicide, there was something happened within them. There was something that triggered all these other things, and after. We call it the Magna Murder. After the Faust Magna Murder, it just seems like they were all immune. It made them all immune. It was just like everything was just erased, you know, and throwing death threats and burning down churches and even taking it as far as killing your best friend was suddenly not as far away as it was before. So to me, these three murders in the film kind of like brought them to the next level. So that's why that scene is very important to understand why they were going the way they were going.
From what I understand about the whole saga of getting the Lords of Chaos movie made, there was originally a script floated around by Adam Parfrey from Feral House in 05-06. That's is not the script that was used?
No, I mean, historically, I've heard about different Lords of Chaos Norwegian black metal scripts for the last 15, 20 years. Mm. And I know other people that tried it. And every time that happened, I kind of, in a weird way, always knew that that's never going to happen. I'm the one that's going to do it. Mm. But I've kind of been waiting it out a little bit. And I think all these stories there's a timing for everything. I'm actually happy I didn't make this movie 5 or 10 or 15 years ago, because now I feel like the time is right for it. But I never read any other script. I know there was a Japanese guy who came pretty far with it, actually, who had a script that was very different from mine, because it was very... He almost made them superheroes, you know, with the corpse makeup and like all that stuff. And I know that there was the Adam script, and there was like, I heard about like all kind of like different scripts. But what I decided to do early on was to write it myself. So me and my partner Dennis, kind of like, we wanted to start clean and make our version of this story. So that's how I did it.
Knowing that you are at the helm of this project, at the helm of this movie, should put a lot of people's minds at ease, simply because you are coming to this movie, this story, from a Scandinavian point of view, which people must acknowledge is a very specific way to view the world. The outlook when you go to Norway, anyone else is a tourist. Your vantage point must be. That's why honestly, I like you said, I've heard about this Lords of Chaos movie being made, like everyone else, for years, to the point where it's became like Chinese Democracy. Is it ever going to get put out, right? So when Mark just casually mentioned, you know, he's screening Lords of Chaos, the movie, I'm like, it's done? This exists? And then I realized, yeah, you're pretty much the perfect person to retell the story with your resume, your body of work. Obviously that sets you ahead of the game, but like I said, your Scandinavian point of view, myself spending so much time in Scandinavia over the past 17 years, I know that there's a very particular way of being from that point of from that part of the world. And obviously I know the answer to this question, but did it shaped the story from you when you were writing the screenplay?
I think so. Well, and I hope so. I mean, like I said, number one, I wanted to make a great movie, you know, and of course I wanted it to feel, to have that part of the appeal of it is that it did happen in Norway and in Scandinavia, and make it as authentic as I could, you know. And I think a lot of the references that we had in our head and the memories from when we were growing up, and like, you know, just seeing how Jeronimo's home looks in the beginning of the film and how their stupid garden party they had looked. I mean, I used only references from my own garden parties when I was 14, 15 years to create that scene. I didn't even know if the black metal guys had those parties, but I added it into the script because it felt like they should, you know. Right. So yes, of course, there was a lot of like practical things and references that I used a lot more than I do in any other American or whatever productions I do. So yes, I did pull from my memory bank a lot. But the biggest challenge was the mentality and the way they spoke and the way they were behaving. And like I said, as much as I said all along I wanted to be as authentic and real as I could, the big step away from the reality is to use English-speaking actors to make the movie. And that is, I got criticized a lot for it even before the movie was done. It's like, how can you do that? You know, it's going to be a Hollywood production, blah, blah, blah. It's not a Hollywood production at all, by the way, but it's a. To me, it was. I'm not going to go through all this and try to tell this story without doing my best to get a big audience and get the best possible actors I can get. And that made it a natural step for me to make it an English-speaking movie. You know, I couldn't really see it any other way. And now looking at the finished piece, just like, you know, okay, they speak English, but it feels very authentic and it feels very Scandinavian to me. You know, so yeah.
I guess what I was meaning to say is, you being Swedish, and even though you're retelling a Norwegian-based story, a Swede would be able to know the differences between Norwegians and Swedish. I mean, whereas anyone else, an American, wouldn't be able to decipher.
Right. No, and it's actually there's one part of this story that I wish I could have had in a movie, but you can only fit so much into a movie, which was the fade that was going on between the Norwegian and the Norwegian black metal scene and the Swedish thrash scene, you know, the death metal scene. It was right. There was like a whole rivalry thing going on which was kind of interesting. That could actually be a whole other movie. Because it was really interesting to see. And it's actually, when I go to Norway, it really feels like I'm going to a different country than Sweden. It's very, very different.
Yeah.
We look the same, and I guess we eat the same and we breathe the same air, but it's so different in mentality. And
there is, I've spent so much time in Sweden that when I go to Norway, I'm totally aware of the differences.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting, actually.
It's hard to describe, even though I've been through it.
Yeah.
You just feel it. It's something I can totally relate. I understand what you mean.
Actually, now when we talk about it like this, it's like, if you think about this story, Lords of Chaos, it actually could have been a TV series instead of a movie, because there's so many things that I couldn't go into. Mm-hmm. You know, like the whole journalist's perspective, the police investigation, the Sweden-Norwich fade, like, you know, the parents, the music, you know, the trial, later the trial. And like, there's so many side things. And Euronymous extreme, like, you know, thinking about marketing and thinking globally. Pre-internet, it was amazing that he had that, and all the tapes he was sending around the world, and like all that stuff. Those were things that I couldn't get into in the movie, because there's not enough room in just a movie. This would have been an interesting series, actually, where you have more time to go deep into all the aspects of it.
Sure. I mean, now I guess with the sudden advent of the proliferation of Netflix seasons and four episodic, you know, shows and stuff, I guess, yeah, definitely.
And I love those long documentaries now. That, you know, I just finished The Grateful Dead one. I don't know if you've seen it. It's like, it's on Amazon. I was never a big Deadhead or anything, but it's just so incredible that you can get 6 hours to go deep into all aspects of their, of what they did, what they achieved, you know. And Wild Wild Country is one I would recommend. Yeah, so it's, I mean, it's long, but it's like, you know, you get the whole thing, you know. So I mean, and this, like, between 83, 84 up to like 90, there's like a 10-year thing in Norway that it's really interesting what happened, you know.
And again, I have to press that you have super cred being in. You know, your time you spent in Bathory. I mean, I think any kind of criticism anyone has against you making this film, I mean, all you have to do is show them your credentials, and that should just shut them up. So am I right to assume that your first music video was a Candlemass video?
Yeah.
So it starts off with like super metallic cred.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Well, no, I was lucky to end up in a production company in Stockholm at right around the right time. Sweden was the last country in the world to get commercial TV, and there was such a huge need for people who could film and you know, just there wasn't even any commercial or music video directors around. It's like, you know, Ingmar Bergman country and the Dramatic Institute and the government-owned TV and like all that stuff. So I started right around the right time, and film editing became like a passion for me and really took over, and it was no question for me that editing was what I was meant to do in my life and not playing drums anymore.
Right.
It was an easy choice, and film editing just became like, you know, my big passion. And I was lucky to work in that environment where there was so much going on. And I worked on music videos. This is way before MTV existed in Europe at all. But we still did a lot of music-driven things. And my best friends are in all these bands, you know. So that's how I started to do music videos. And Candlemass was like, you know, like a really early thing. It's like, okay, here's the camera. It's like, which direction do we shoot? You know, and then it's just like, okay, we put it together. We make a little story here. I love that that video is still around. I love that you even know about it, that it's still around, and that YouTube exists. So it's out there to see.
Yeah.
But, you know, that and the fact that I worked in this production company that really encouraged new thinking, and that became not only my film school, but it became like the whole country of Sweden's film school, that era where you, because there wasn't any film schools, but we had a chance to actually work with real budgets and real clients and real, with a very high ambition level, you know. So there was an explosion of great directors and filmmakers that came out of that era that are now all working around the world, you know. It's incredible that happened, you know.
A friend of mine, I've been told, studied under you, Amir, from Infinite Mass.
Yeah, of course.
And he's done some great videos on his own. And what's the connection between Amir and you?
Well, I known him forever, and actually I know you guys are friends because he talked a lot about you. And we had a production company back where we represented him as a director. So my company produced all his music videos, and we became friends. And today I consider him one of my best friends. You know, he's my first call when I get back to Sweden, always.
Really?
Yeah, no, and he comes here, and we actually represent him here in America too. And he just finished a TV series in Sweden. He's great. He's awesome.
I know he's got like two movies out, but they're in Swedish, so I don't really...
Yeah.
I don't understand them. But one was with Hank from Turbo Negro, right?
Yeah.
That was... I wanted to watch it. I just don't.
Yeah, no, he
did. Don't understand it.
He did. His first movie was like really brave. Such a brave guy. He made a black and white movie about his father, and he played his father in the movie. I mean, it's just about his father coming to Sweden back in the 70s. It was an incredible art. It's an art movie, but it's incredible how he did that. And then his second movie is about Cornelis Vreeswijk, this very famous Swedish singer-songwriter.
Okay, and that's who Hank...
Hank played. Yeah.
And I saw Hank, around the time the movie came out, I saw Hank on one of those Swedish TV shows in Sweden where I think they... Do they set up in Liseberg? And it's just like families singing like together and on the weekends or something? And Hank was there like on that stage with a suit singing... And we all know how Hank really is.
Yeah.
So it was a bit kind of jarring. But I think it was to promote Amir's movie.
Yeah, it must have been.
Yeah.
It must have been, yeah. Yeah.
I don't think any of the Turbo Jugend saw that. You know? It's pretty cool. I've always wanted to know that connection.
Yeah.
I haven't seen Amir in a few years. But I always loved his music videos. And I heard that he had kind of... There was some... understudy connection with you and him, like he studied under you or something like that.
Yeah, no, we known each other for a while, and I'm a few years older than him, so he came in a little later. But he was early on, though, both with his band, but also the way they approached music videos with Infinite Mass. They were like, you know, okay, we can't find anybody to do it; we'll do it ourselves. And all those videos look better than.
Right.
Most other videos back then, you know. So, and like I said, he just finished a TV series too, a big TV series for Swedish TV. So,
what's that about?
It's like one of those crime, you know, like detective, like typical Norwegian, Scandinavian crime thing, you know.
Yeah. No, I Yeah, I know. I know those. Those are very popular. Yeah, cool. Yeah, I'm on an Infinite Mass record, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I do some sort of intro on it. I went in one day. It's him. It was, I think him and Dragon were in the studio and and laid some stuff down. Yeah. And when is the movie going to be out?
Well, we did Sundance, which was great. It was amazing to finally see it with an audience. And it was amazing for me to see how well it was received with the audience in the room. They were really in the story, and I could feel the energy in the room, just like following all the ups and downs in the movie. It was incredible to see that.
I'm super excited to see this movie.
Yeah, no, and then we got some great reviews and all that. So what we did when you do these kind of independent movies is like, you know, then you start to shop around and see who would release it for you. And so we got it down. We got offers, and we got a release plan that's going to... this fall, it's going to slowly come out in different countries throughout the fall. You know, that's my hopes. And it's probably going to be... you know, you're going to probably have to look for it a little bit, but it's going to be around, and it's going to be... And there's two versions of it, because here in America we got an NC-17 rating, which is not... that great, because none of the movie theaters around America would ever show an NC-17. So I had to do a censored version, basically, that's called an R version.
Oh, wow.
So there's two versions. There's an R version and an unrated version, we call it now.
Okay. Well, but then the rest of the world gets the real uncut version.
It's different from different countries. Some countries are very strict with their censorship, but have platforms where you can see it. You know, and obviously my hope is that the unrated version is going to be the one that most people see, because that's really my vision. That's really what I wanted to do. You know, and unfortunately, a lot of these streaming platforms doesn't do NC-17 either. So,
really?
Yeah, those days are over, man.
Wow. Huh.
Yeah.
Because I just saw this, I just downloaded this Rocco Siffredi reality show when I was in the UK, and they show everything there. That's interesting.
Well, that I don't know. I don't know where you downloaded it. And I mean, horror movies get away with a lot. You know, there's different types of the problem with this movie is that it's very real, and it's young people, and it's a suicide, and it's like it's all the sensitive matters that you can think of. Mm-hmm. And I get it. It's like everybody's just doing their job, you know, and the MPAA, whatever they're called, the organization in America, it's their responsibility. That's what they do, you know.
Yeah.
But it's kind of sad to realize that there's no platform for it. You know, what happened to all those great NC-17 movies that we grew up on, or that nobody's ever going to see again because there's no platform for it? It's kind of sad.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to make sure I see the real version of it when it comes out. I'm very excited about it. I love the book. And that's another thing. Were you in contact with Michael Moynihan and the authors of Lords of Chaos and Diedrich?
No, I wasn't.
Oh, that's really interesting. And Adam Parfrey's script is not a part of this movie either.
No.
Ah, it's very interesting. It's a real interpretation of the story.
Well, I think you can give this story to 100 writers and you get 100 different versions of it. I really think so. There's so many different ways of what you can focus on and how you want to tell this story. But, you know, it's like... I don't know if you think we talked enough about it, but I can talk about it forever. But, you know, to me, the most intriguing part of the story was the relationship between these young boys and how it could happen. How could this really happen, you know?
Yeah.
And that sounds like a lame story because we all want to see black metal and party and violence and like all that stuff. But it's in the movie, too. That's in the movie, too. But it's like, you know, what really makes it interesting to me is like... I got children, and I know you do too, and you start to think about all these things, and you think about the choices that you took yourself when you were that age. And you, at least I remember when I took some decisions in my life that took me to where I am, And I remember even places where I took a decision when I'm happy I didn't take the other decision because I saw what happened to other people, you know. So you got to have a little bit of luck and common sense to end up where you are, you know. And just that's just fascinating to me that that could happen, you know. Mm. And they were young. They were so young. You know, imagine like, and they were so driven. Imagine like being at that age and have your own band and label and touring and record stores and representing bands and killing people and burning down churches. And like, that's a lot of work, all those things. They were so fucking driven, man. It's like, you know, it's incredible how they got all that done in such a short time, you know. And all the creativity, of course, you know. And I, you know, I try to not talk much about Varg, but his music is fucking great, you know. It's like they were so young and they created that music, you know. It's incredible.
I'm very respectful that you took this story on. Mm. It's a powerful story, but like I said, a minefield, a brave thing for you to do. And if you're telling me the reviews coming in are great, man, I think you just won.
Yeah, well, I just want, right now I'm just at that place where I just want people to see it, you know. It's like, you know, and I think the movie may not be what a lot of people expect it to be, and again, I every second in this film is my take on it, and I take full responsibility for it. This is the story I wanted to tell, you know. It's like it came out the way I wanted, except the censored version. I hate that, you know. Filmmaking is it's a bitch. It's the worst art form. You're always in the hands of circumstances and budgets and schedules, and I got so far with this movie. I was like, yes, I got it, and then the censor showed up and fucked it up at the end. You know, so it's like.
But you got your version.
I got my version. Yeah, so it's fine, and eventually, it'll be one of those movies that's going to grow. It's not going to be. It's not the Marvel movie that has the first weekend and then it just like goes away. This movie will be around for a while. There's a lot of time for everybody to see it.
Right. Now I can't end this podcast without asking you, are you a fan of Toronto now? You spent so much time there.
I am actually.
Yeah.
I think I was before too. Obviously, I haven't spent that much time before, but now after being there for 5 months, I left some really good friends there, and definitely some great memories. And I brought a really fucking awesome movie in the can with me here to edit. So, yeah, you know, and Mark and all those guys that I left behind there, I consider them my friends, you know. So, yeah, no, it's great.
Yeah.
The thing was that everybody was like, you know, yeah, you're gonna get a lot of snow. And I was like, what if we don't? Don't worry, man. And then we didn't have enough snow.
Yeah, yeah.
So there we are. It was still cold. It was like 20 below, and then we needed to bring out the snow machines, which was kind of annoying.
Yeah.
But no, I loved it, and I'm a sucker for Asian food, and I was right in that neighborhood, so I was gaining a lot of weight. But other than that, it was awesome.
Oh, that's great. Good to hear. And are you going to... Mark told me you're going to be in and out of Toronto for the next few months?
Yeah, I mean, we are officially doing the post there. I'm just doing my offline editing here, but everything else is done there. So I'm going to do sound mix. I'm going to go. There's a fantastic post house there called Mr. X, which is doing all my special effects and stuff. So I'll be there. And then we actually have, because in the movie, there's one scene that's summer. So we have one more scene to shoot. So I'm coming back for another couple of days of shooting.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
If you ever have a screening in Toronto for Lords, I'd love to attend.
Why don't we just set one up just for you, Danko?
That would be awesome.
Let's do it. Let's do it. Seriously, I can do that. I can easily do that. And that production company, the post house where I work, they had a pretty good screening room. So that's where we did it last time. So I'll set one up for you.
Oh, I would love it.
And then you bring your music friends.
You bring
Rush.
Yeah, I don't know if I could do that.
They're tough. I'm a big Rush fan, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. So am I. Yeah,
yeah.
Absolutely. The house I grew up in is in the Subdivisions video. That's my claim to fame.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, you have more claim to fame than that, though.
Thanks, man.
All right. Well, thank you.